Well, good afternoon. Happy Sabbath. I really enjoy these occasions. I didn't know there were going to be this many young people here, and it reminds me of almost a year ago in February of last year when we had the dance in Dallas, and we had, I think if I remember the number correctly, 501 people for services, and they say the Church of God is full of old folks and there are no young people around. Well, look around, you know. I think we've got the disproof of that before our eyes right now in this room. So welcome to everybody who's here. Thank you for all the work that's gone into the basketball weekend. I'm not going to be playing basketball, but I may come and give a cheer tomorrow morning, and looking forward to that, staying over tonight with the Hammers in their home. Thank you very much to them as well. I saw them. They're here somewhere. There they are. Okay. Looking forward to spending the weekend here in the East Texas area. I think you've got most of the news. I usually begin with a little bit of news from the office, but news travels fast these days. Mr. Franks is back. He was in the office yesterday. He constantly surprises me. I'm amazed at the way he's able to bounce back after, I think, about a 17-hour jet lag, time lag. But he was there, and he looked remarkably awake to me, and getting to grips with some of the things that have to be done. I think you know all about the trip to India and Sri Lanka. You've had all of the news. Not much else. I actually brought the news, my notes here from our office meeting on Tuesday morning, but you've heard just about everything. Connections for the Friday Night Live last Friday evening were 363, according to the number that was given in the office meeting on Tuesday morning, so that's very good. Some of those connections represent several people listening, so it looks as if we probably had about 1,000 people, roughly 1,000 people, tuning into the Friday Night Live Bible study. I think it was the first one a week from last night, so please be sure to check that out. Would also just add my request for prayers for Mr. Henson. I've had privilege of working with him on the doctrine committee, and he's worked very hard. He served as the chairman of the doctrine committee, and this heart attack that he had, I think, 2 or 3 days ago came as a bit of a shock. But I do believe the email that we had was a good one. I think he's on the up and up and recovering. But please keep him in your prayers. Please also keep Mr. Larry Roybal in your prayers. I had the privilege of being in Monterrey, Mexico this time last week. And a very nice congregation there, not a terribly large one, but very, very fine congregation. First time I've been in Mexico in many, many years. Mr. and Mrs. Roybal were not there. Service took place in their home, which is the usual arrangement, and I got to spend some time with the brethren. But I know Mr. Roybal was very eager to get back and missing everybody, and I know they were missing him as well. As I think you all know, he's got cancer and rather an aggressive form, but I also know that a lot of prayer is being sent up on his behalf. So would ask you please to continue to pray for Mr. Larry Roybal, our pastor from Mexico. And of course, there are many others who are requesting prayer at this time. We've had a lot of prayer requests over the last few weeks. Seems like since the Feast of Tabernacles, there have been a lot of prayer requests. I think that's about all the news. So I'll finish and sit down. Oh, I'm expected to preach a sermon. Okay. They made it at last. At least they're halfway there. They're looking forward to their destination. They've made it to a temporary resting place. 10 commandments have been given. The book of the law has been made known to the people. The essentials of the way of life that God requires of them have been made known. And they're kind of camped down at the halfway place, which most people think was in the southern Sinai Peninsula. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Exodus, chapter 19 and verse 1 to start out. Exodus 19, verse 1. Exodus 19, verse 1, to get a little bit of the time frame for the incident that I'd like for us to focus on this afternoon in the service. Exodus 19, verse 1 says, "In the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai, approaching the time of the Feast of Pentecost." As you probably know, they made very good progress at the beginning of their movement, and things got kind of bogged down after that. And what I'd like to do in the sermon this afternoon is look at one of the reasons why things got bogged down as badly as they did. Exodus 19 and verse 8, just before the Ten Commandments are given, and Moses tells them that God wants to enter into a covenant with them. Exodus 19, verse 8 says, "Then all the people answered together and said, all that the Eternal has spoken, we will do. So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Eternal. And in the next chapter, as you know, we find the Ten Commandments given directly from God. FI students are here. They know what was on the reflection paper and what I emphasized when we went over this. Do require the FI students to remember the Ten Commandments, short form or long form, one form or another. And hopefully we all do. We know the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. And then in chapters 20 through 24, we've got what's referred to as the Book of the Law. And after that, there's a lot of instruction about preparation for the tabernacle and the ordination of Aaron as the first high priest, and expectations are running high, and then it all went wrong. Where's Moses? Where's the old man? Well, he's just up the mountain. The old man's gone, 40 days and 40 nights. And when the old man's gone, you don't know what's going to happen. He's gone for a long time. He's disappeared. And as we know from the account, Moses is very much a controlling factor with Israel, a very carnal nation, a nation that reacted in a carnal and very physical way. The old saying, you know, look busy when the boss is watching. The boss was gone. The leader is absent. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 7 ties in with this. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 7. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 7, an interesting scripture here, and the interpretation of this scripture has varied just a little bit from time to time, but it indicates something that sometimes when the controlling factor, the controlling personality is not there, things can go badly. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 7 talks about the mystery of lawlessness already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. This mystery of lawlessness that begins to operate when the leader is absent. Getting back to the story in the book of Exodus, as we've gone through all of this, then at some point, as you probably know, catastrophe strikes. Everything goes wrong. Now, the word catastrophe is sort of tied in, I think, with astrology, so it's maybe not the right word to use, but it gets the point across. Everything goes wrong. Everything blows up. Everything goes wrong. And the golden calf incident takes place. The golden calf. Now, some of us are old enough to remember the movie The Ten Commandments. And it was really, I think it's been years since I've seen it, been quite a good depiction of what took place at the time of the golden calf incident. What I want to do this afternoon is look at the golden calf incident and learn some lessons from three men. Three men and their reactions to the golden calf incident. And ask ourselves the question, how would we have reacted, and what may we learn from these three men and the event at Mount Sinai? How do we react when we're faced with the golden calf? The title of the sermon is Three Men and a Calf. Three Men and a Calf. Let's go to Exodus chapter 32. I find this whole incident very, very interesting. I know we've all read it before, but there are so many lessons of leadership to derive from this one chapter. And there are personalities that play into this that show us something, and some very important lessons, I think, for us as members and prospective members of God's church, both young and old. Let's begin with Exodus chapter 32 and verse 1. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron. The relationship between Moses and Aaron is a very interesting one. It will be beyond the scope of the sermon to take sufficient time to discuss Aaron. I find Aaron a very interesting individual, several years older than Moses, and yet. So they gather to Aaron, and they say to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. And I think they probably said it in a disrespectful tone, in a sneering tone. The old man's disappeared up the mountain, and he left you in charge. Now, Aaron was the older brother, remember. Moses is the younger brother. The old man disappeared up the mountain, and you're in charge here. And they begin to put pressure on him, not to return to Egypt physically, but to return to Egypt in a spiritual sense. Let's keep on reading here. This is very interesting, the whole incident. Verse 2, it's sad, but it's fascinating. Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in your ears, the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Where did the earrings come from? This was probably the material that they brought when they spoiled the Egyptians. They brought a lot of material with them, including some animals, no doubt, to sacrifice to God and so on. And they've got gold, and they've got earrings, and they've got jewelry. And Aaron, don't you find it interesting? There's no account of Aaron resisting. Now, we know that the Bible is brief. The Bible is terse, and sometimes we get events kind of telescoped together. But the thing that we read in verse 2, Aaron says, "Break off your earrings and all of your jewelry." And of course, we know what's about to happen. Verse 3, "So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf." Now, okay, admittedly, in most of the Old Testament, we don't get a lot of interior thought. We're not told what's he thinking. But, of course, we want to know, what's he thinking? I mean, what was he thinking? This is horrible. This was a catastrophe. This was a mess. And it threatened the entire undertaking of getting the children of Israel out of Egyptian captivity and into the Promised Land. Did he resist? I suspect they maybe nagged at him, and they pressured him, and they pushed him. But the text says, the Bible itself says, that Aaron was the one who got this engraving tool, and he made a molded calf. By the way, here in verse, at the end of verse 4, we'll get ahead of myself, there in verse 1 as well, "Come, make us gods." And the word for gods is Elohim used there, and it's the word, in many contexts, used for the true God. It's a plural, as I think you know. But it can refer here to idols in this context is what it means. Verse 4, second part of the verse, they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you up out of the land of Egypt." No, it wasn't. The true God had brought them out of the land of Egypt. The true God took it on. He's the one who pushes forward all of his plan. But, you know, it's human nature to seek something that can be seen rather than to worship something that can't be seen. Verse 5, "When Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it," there in verse 5. And I find Aaron's entire role fascinating as we go through all of this. Isn't this interesting what Aaron does? He builds an altar and he says, he made a proclamation and he says, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Eternal," in verse 5. Was it on the sacred calendar? We don't know. I think perhaps not. Aaron sort of tries to make amends. He tries to blend it all together. Was Aaron troubled in his conscience? And therefore he tried to take something that was thoroughly pagan and baptize it. This is a feast too, and look at that, the Lord, in the capital letters, that's the YHVH, that's the covenant name of God. One of the lessons that we get from this is a lesson that you and I act out every year when we get to the winter, when we get to the month of December, and that is that you can't take a pagan practice and a pagan celebration and baptize it. I'm amazed when I look on some of the social media and I look at things, comments written by people that I once knew and people that I once went to college with and taught here in this part of the state of Texas, and the direction that they've gone and some of the things that they will say about the December festival. It's as if they've just lost it completely. People should know better. We know you can't take and baptize paganism, and yet it looks as if that's what Aaron is trying to do here. He's trying to mix it all up in a kind of a syncretistic mash of worship of the true God along with everything else. Verse 6, "They rose early the next day, they offered burnt offerings, and they brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play." We get a huge lesson out of all of this. We haven't finished reading yet, but there are some things to note about Aaron as we move through this. The background on Aaron is really very interesting. When we get a little bit earlier in the book of Exodus, and you probably remember the story, you remember Moses getting commissioned by God? And Moses turns it down. You know, he's got the prophetic rejection reaction. "No, I don't want to do it. No, I don't want to do it. No, I don't want to do it." He keeps kind of pushing it away. "No, no, 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 no. I don't want to do it." And one of the reasons he said he didn't want to do it was because he didn't have the gift of the gab. He wasn't articulate. He wasn't eloquent. Let's keep our place in Exodus chapter 32 and go back to Exodus chapter 4, because I think there's a lesson in this that as God's people we must not overlook. Exodus 4, verses 14 through 16. Moses pushing it away. I don't want it. I don't want to do it. When you look at the rest of the book of Exodus, and especially the book of Numbers, you can see the reason why. It was a miserable job, frankly. Exodus 4, verse 14. The anger of the Eternal was kindled against Moses, and he said, "Is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know he can speak well. And look, he's coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart." They've been apart for some length of time. "Now you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you should do. So he shall be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God." The way it describes the relationship between Moses and Aaron is the same way it describes the relationship between God and a prophet. In fact, it will use that term later on. Let's take a look at that. Exodus 7 and verse 1. Exodus 7 and verse 1. As you go through all of this Old Testament history, which of course I've done many times in teaching this material, it's very interesting, as you begin to get into all of it, Aaron is actually very prominent. And the name of Aaron begins to fade as time goes by, as Moses grows a little bit in confidence. But remember, keep in mind, Aaron was the guy who was the good speaker. Exodus 7, verse 1. "The Eternal said to Moses, 'See, I've made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron, your brother, shall be your prophet.'" So in all probability, at this phase in these course of events, Aaron was the one doing the talking, and Moses begins at least telling him the things to do. And yet, back in Exodus chapter 32, who was the guy who caved in to popular pressure? What would have happened had Moses not been up the mountain? How would the history have been written? There's a famous quote, maybe it's not that famous, but it's a quote that's very relevant to what we're discussing here, from Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of Britain. Tony Blair is quoted as saying, "The art of leadership is saying no, not yes. It is very easy to say yes." Now, maybe there's something we should learn from all of this. It will be Aaron who caves. And yet Aaron was the one who spoke well. Aaron was the one who had, if you will, better personality. Aaron was also the one who tried to mix it all up, tried to take paganism and baptize it. The Israelites, no doubt, had brought a lot of affection for Egyptian religion out with them. The Egyptian religions, like all the pagan religions, in a way were very, very appealing. One of the things we cover as we go through the Old Testament in our Bible classes is the way the pagan religions worked. They were very appealing. Of course, you had figurines and gods and things you could touch and so on. They were very, very sensual. You could see the pagan gods. You couldn't see the true God. You couldn't touch the true God. And if you remember the Ten Commandments movie, you remember... I won't ask everybody because some of the people here won't remember Yul Brynner, you know, with the bald head. Some of you do, okay, and you don't want to admit it, right? For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, you can probably get it on Netflix, I imagine. Yul Brynner, was he sort of stripped to the waist and with a bald head and so on? If I remember, it's been a long time since I've seen it. But that movie was really pretty accurate because what it depicts at the foot of the mountain, you remember, some of you have seen it. If you haven't, it's a good movie and worth seeing because it's got a big lesson in it. They're having a big party at the foot of the mountain and it develops into essentially what was an orgy. And that's the way the pagan religions were. They were very appealing. It sort of combined this worship of the false gods together with a sort of very erotic, sensual type of approach to religion. And they got really, really carried away. Exodus 32 and verse 6. Exodus 32, verse 6. "Then they rose early the next day, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play." 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 7. We'll come back to Exodus 32. Sorry, I did that too late. Some of you closed your Bibles to Exodus 32. We're coming back to Exodus 32. We'll keep gravitating back to Exodus 32. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7, makes pretty clear what was going on. It talks about lusting after evil things in verse 6. And then in verse 7 it says, "And do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." The battle against idolatry is a battle that took place throughout the Old Testament, and I think even on into the New Testament when the New Testament church was founded. Aaron tried to take something ungodly and make it godly, and you can't do that. We understand that. We know that very clearly. Well, what was Aaron's reaction? Let's go back to Exodus chapter 32, where Moses has confronted him, and we'll come back to some of this material here as we move through. Exodus chapter 32, and God tells Moses, and I'm going to paraphrase here, beginning around verse 7. God tells Moses, "Go down quickly. Go down quickly." Because something very bad is going on down at the bottom of the mountain. Let's jump forward a little bit to Exodus 32, verses 21 through 24. Exodus 32, verses 21 through 24. "And Moses said to Aaron," here's the confrontation, "what did this people do to you that you've brought so great sin upon them?" So Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot." The relationship between Aaron and Moses is an interesting one. He refers to his own brother as my Lord, but he didn't do the right thing. "Don't let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they're set on evil." Wait a second, I thought we just read that it was Aaron himself who fashioned the calf. "For they said to me, 'Make us gods that shall go before us.' As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him." And that was a reasonably accurate quote from what they said, wasn't it? The old man, he's up the mountain. Is he coming down the mountain? Who cares? We're rid of him. Let's have a party. Verse 24, "And I said to them, 'Whoever has any gold, let them break it off.' So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out." And yes, it is amusing, isn't it? It is amusing. You know about golden calves. They just got a mind of their own. They're popping out of fires the whole time, you know? Happens all the time. Golden calves pop out of fires. Yeah, it is amusing, and I suppose it's intended to be amusing. Lesson here, though, obviously, there's a lesson here, and that is that true leaders take responsibility for their actions. When you analyze the words that Aaron reports to Moses and the way it's described earlier in chapter 32 of the book of Exodus, there's a slight difference of emphasis, is there not? And that, too, is part of human nature. Aaron says, "Well, it just kind of happened. It slipped. I wasn't responsible for it." True leaders take responsibility for their actions. Verse 33. We'll move forward a little bit and look at what it says here. We get an important principle here. "The Eternal said to Moses, 'Whoever sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book.'" We look at one of those lessons. And at this point, of course, I'm jumping over a little bit of material here. But Moses tried to intercede for the people, and God said, "No, you're responsible for your own actions." True leaders take responsibility for their actions. We live in a world where people don't take responsibility for their actions. Or politicians, when they're caught doing certain things, then they come forward. You can think of events in the press recently. Even over the last couple of weeks, they get caught doing certain things, and then they say, "My bad, you know, the hand in the air, basketball foul, my bad. I'm responsible." But it's late at that point because they do it because they got caught. We think maybe of King Saul later on and the spoils and Agag and one thing, and there's so many examples of this in the Bible. True leaders take responsibility for their actions. But maybe there's another lesson here as we look at the example of Aaron and we look at the example of Moses. Let's keep in mind what we read about the background of them both. Moses was the lousy speaker. Aaron was the good speaker. Aaron was the one with probably the much more attractive personality. Let's hold the thought, and we'll revisit that shortly, because this is all full of lessons for us. And let's move forward a little bit, and I'd like to focus on man number two. Aaron was number one. This second person we're going to take a look at gets a little bit of press in Exodus chapter 32, but his life is full of lessons as well. And here in Exodus 32 and verse 17, one man is mentioned here who's going to figure very large elsewhere in the Bible. Exodus 32 and verse 17. Joshua coming down the mountain with Moses, Exodus 32, verse 17, when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There is a noise of war in the camp." They're coming down the mountain, Joshua and Moses together, and Joshua hears the commotion, Yul Brynner and the guys down at the foot of the mountain, everything going on. And Joshua says, "There's a battle going on at the bottom of the mountain." And Moses, who has greater experience and greater knowledge and probably greater discernment at this point, says, "No, no, that's not what it is." Verse 18, but he, Moses, said, "It's not the noise of the shout of victory, nor the noise of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear." Moses knew what was going on. Joshua didn't. How do you see Joshua here? A little naive? It's very early in his involvement in the events in the plan of God. A little naive, perhaps? Inexperienced, perhaps? Joshua had had a good bit of experience, you know. We could go back and look at some of the things that had already happened in his life. Back in Exodus chapter 17, and I'll simply allude to it, you've got Amalek fighting against Joshua leading the army of Israel down at the foot of the mountain. And you remember in this very famous scene where you've got Aaron and Hur up at the top of the mountain holding up Moses' hands. So Joshua knew about military undertakings. He knew about battles. But he didn't have an awful lot of knowledge of what it was when people lapse into paganism. He didn't have an awful lot of discernment of what it was when people get carried away with things they ought not to get carried away with. Later on, in the book of Numbers, you remember that Joshua was one of the two. In Numbers 13 and 14, and again, we're not going to take the time to go there, but I think we know the history there where Joshua, actually 12, were sent out. You remember all of that. 12 were sent out. And it was Joshua and Caleb who came back with the positive report. And they said, "We're going to take that land because God is with us." Interesting fellow, Joshua. A lot of things happened in his life. A lot of experience took place as time went by. One book of the Bible named after him. Let's look at a couple of little more details. We're going to come back to Exodus chapter 32. But a couple more details about Joshua, because I think this is important. And I'm kind of glad that we get to cover some of this with a lot of young people here, because I think this is important. We're seeing a man here who's going to be used very significantly by God. And at this juncture in his life, he lacked the experience to really understand what was going on. Numbers 11, verse 28. We're coming back to Exodus 32. Numbers 11, verse 28. Another fascinating early example of Joshua, who's going to become the leader of Israel's army as they are led of God to take the promised land. Numbers chapter 11 and verse 28. This is an incident when there were a couple of men staying back in the camp. You can read about it there in verse 27. And it says, and a young man runs and tells Moses, "There are two guys in the camp and they're prophesying." And Joshua says, one of his choice men said, "Moses, my Lord, forbid them." "Stop it, Moses. Don't let them do that." And Moses' reaction is, "Oh, I wish everybody prophesied, because they'd be a whole lot easier to lead if they all prophesied." Verse 29, "Oh, that all the Eternal's people were prophets, and that the Eternal would put his spirit upon them." And Moses returned to the camp, he and the elders of Israel. Now, this is not an advertisement for Pentecostalism. That's not the point. The point being that Moses' role would have been a whole lot easier had all of the people of God been imbued or had received, at least in that Old Testament manner, the Spirit. It would have been Moses' job would have been easier. But again, Joshua's lack of wisdom and lack of judgment is highlighted here. In Exodus 18, verse 21, and again, we're going to come back to Exodus 32. Exodus 18 and verse 21, Another interesting incident here involving Moses' father-in-law, Jethro. Exodus 18, verse 21. Look at this. By the way, we looked at these scriptures when the Church of God, a worldwide association, was forming. We looked at these scriptures and we analyzed them very closely as characteristics of leadership for God's people down through the ages. Jethro gives Moses a piece of advice here, Exodus 18, verse 21. The scene is where Moses is wearing himself out. He's the only judge, and he's overdoing it. And his father-in-law, Jethro, comes to him and gives him a very wise piece of advice. Exodus 18, verse 21, "Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens." It was a very good piece of advice and one that Moses put into effect. But the interesting thing is that Moses, as is Joshua, did not become one of those rulers, as far as we know. It didn't include Joshua. What does all this lead to? Joshua making a couple of early guest appearances and later becoming very prominent in what God was doing at this phase in the Old Testament history. I suggest to you there are a couple of lessons here that we can derive from the life of Joshua. Joshua will become very prominent. He'll become the leader when they conquer the land. Lesson number one that I would suggest, that steadfastness and commitment precede experience and judgment. Steadfastness and commitment precede experience and judgment. I think that's a big lesson from our experience in God's church, from the experience we can see from the Bible. We've got some here, I'm sure, who would like to be involved in serving the church, maybe even think about perhaps someday being in a position of service and leadership in the church. Steadfastness and commitment precede experience and judgment. That's not to say that experience and judgment are not important. They are. They're very important. But as a start, you know, reverse it. What if you've got somebody with lots of experience, but they lack the steadfastness? That's happened, hasn't it? You can think of examples, and so can I. Without the steadfastness, without the commitment, all the experience and all the judgment in the world is of no use. It doesn't take you very far. Now, of course, from that comes the immediate question, well, then, okay, you know, somebody's steadfast, somebody's committed to God's work. Don't you need to have good judgment to serve in a position of leadership and service in God's church? Well, yes, of course you do. And sometimes, of course, we wonder, okay, can that be accelerated? Can it be accelerated? You want to learn to serve people. You want to do something for the church. Can you learn experience? Can you pick up judgment? I think the answer to that question is yes, isn't it? That's done by watching closely and by seeing the right examples of others who've got more experience than you, watching the way it works, and even at times watching when things haven't worked out well. Judgment, lesson number two from the life of Joshua. We're digressing a little bit from Exodus 32, I know. But it sparks a lot of thoughts. Lesson number two, judgment and experience come with time. Judgment and experience come with time. But can it be speeded up? Can you accelerate the process if you want to do things better? I think you probably can. You watch. I mean, after all, the Bible is a book of stories. It's a book of object lessons, and by reading those object lessons, we gain experience vicariously. Judgment and experience come with time, but yes, it can be speeded up. We can learn from the experience of others. Don't we do that? Aren't we doing that right now? Learning from the experience of Joshua. Learning from the experience of Moses. The fascinating individual, Joshua, he was a successful leader. Unlike Aaron, in some ways we could say that Aaron was not a terribly successful leader. Joshua was, but he started out at a certain level and he grew into it. Something for us to keep in mind. That's man number two. Man number three, the title of the sermon is Three Men and a Calf. Man number three is, of course, Moses. What to say about Moses? Remarkable individual. Where would we be today if Moses had never come into existence? You know, after all, almost all of the law of God was given through Moses. Not all of it, but almost all of it. A man who is deeply, deeply dedicated. He had a fierce dedication to serving God. A man who was educated and capable. We learn elsewhere in the New Testament that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. He had the educational preparation. He was capable. And yet, as we've already seen, as we've looked at a few scriptures in Exodus 32, he was not, how to put it, charismatic. He was a less attractive personality than Aaron. We saw that he had no gift of the gab. He wasn't a natural speaker. Now, of course, you know, so if somebody's going to give sermonettes and sermons and that kind of thing, the ability to speak is very important. But some people have the ability to speak and they don't have the character to go with it. Some people have the character and they don't have the ability to speak and they have to work hard on developing it. So if you're among those people, don't they say that the greatest fear, people's greatest fear, is public speaking? I've read articles that say the big fear that people have is not, you know, an airplane that goes down or dogs or whatever. The big fear that people have is speaking in public, and many have been through that. But, you know, when the commitment is there, some of the ability can be added on top of it. Moses is an example of that. It's interesting. You follow the entire story through, and it begins talking about God spoke to Moses, and then Moses spoke to Aaron, and then the word was delivered. And as you go through Exodus and later on Numbers and Leviticus as well, Aaron will begin to fade, and Moses grew in confidence. He grew into the job. Nevertheless, people were led off by a man who was much more appealing than Moses, much more appealing. Exodus 32, one more time, and beginning in verse 19. Exodus 32 and beginning in verse 19. Here's what Moses did as this problem developed. What do you think of Moses? I don't know. He was certainly a man of God. But what about his personality? Exodus 32, verse 19. So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. And Moses' anger became hot. He became angry. Isn't it interesting? Moses had a temper on him. And he becomes angry in this instance when he saw what was going on at the bottom of the mountain. People get angry in our society. People blow up. But most people blow up for the wrong reasons. The Bible shows us we should have the ability to get angry for the right reasons. Even among God's people, sometimes we get angry for the wrong reasons because of us. We should get angry because something that pertains to God has been broken. Something hasn't gone well. Verse 19, his anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands, and he broke them at the foot of the mountain. And I find so interesting the fact that as you keep reading through the book of Exodus, there is not one word of censure against Moses for having taken the tablets of the Ten Commandments, if you please, and breaking them at the foot of the mountain. Not one. When does Moses get his censure later on? You remember, and we're not going to take the time to go to read that event, but Moses was supposed to talk to the rock, and he hit the rock twice, and he lost his place in the promised land for that reason, because he got angry. He let it run away with him for the wrong reason. But at this point, he gets angry, and God does not censure him. No. Verse 20. And he took the calf which they had made, and he burned it in the fire, and he ground it to powder, and he scattered it on the water, and he made the children of Israel drink it. I don't know whether they were selling some of it down at the Dairy Queen. Who gets invited, you know? You imagine the scene that night. They're going to have a barbecue, and who gets invited over? Moses? You're invited and you contribute water mixed with gold dust. I don't think so. Probably Moses was not going to win any popularity contest for what he did here. Lesson. Leadership sometimes is not popular. We heard a little bit about that in the sermonette, didn't we? Sometimes you got to do the thing that is not popular. Leadership sometimes is not popular. Leadership sometimes involves doing the tough thing. Moses was not Joel Osteen. All right, some of you watch Joel Osteen. Good, I'm glad. You ever watch Joel Osteen? He comes on occasionally. I switch the TV on a Sunday morning, and it is interesting, isn't it? It is quite interesting. For those of you who don't know, Joel Osteen is the pastor of one of these big mega churches in Houston, I think. Isn't he in Houston? And, you know, they pan over the audience every now and then, and it's hundreds of people. And he gets up with his big smile on his face, and I guess it's not Brill Cream. I don't know what he puts on his hair, but his hair looks all shiny, you know. And he preaches this message that's so popular for people today. Health and wealth. God will bless you. God will pour out all kinds of goodies on you. Just hold out a sheet and you get candy bars all over the place. By the way, did you ever see, you should see sometime, if you haven't seen it, watch a YouTube video where Joel Osteen actually had the courage to correct his congregation. Some of you have seen it. Check it on YouTube when you get a chance. Get onto YouTube and check Joel Osteen where he tells them not to eat pork. It's true. He didn't tell them not to violate the Ten Commandments, but he told them not to eat pork. And he's joking with them. He says, you know, my wife and I, we don't eat the meats that are labeled unclean. We eat chicken, we eat beef. And then he even gets onto seafood, and he says, bar the door, deacons. You know, we don't eat shrimp. And he says, some of you people want to go running for the doors. He tells them not to eat unclean foods. One of the very rare occasions when he's ever told them to not to do anything. He does once in a while use the word repent, but it's, you know, it's in a very sugar-coated kind of a way. And of course, there are lots of people around like that. Moses was exactly the opposite. I see Moses as irascible. I see Moses as not very likable. When they grilled steaks that night, they did not invite Moses over, I'm sure. They may have been inclined to invite Aaron over. They may have been inclined to invite some of Aaron's buddies over, but I don't think Moses got an invitation. In fact, they probably weren't grilling steaks at all. They were probably sitting in their tents feeling wretched and trying to squelch feelings of resentment against Moses because he'd been so tough on them. He'd been so tough on them. Lesson of leadership. Sometimes leadership is not popular. Another lesson of leadership, and a rather big one here, personality is not the same as character. Now, to be a leader, having personality is good. To be engaging, to do well, it's very important in God's church. This is important. But character precedes personality. And if you think, those who've been around the church for a long time, you know, I don't always want to go back on the history, but we've seen lessons of this, haven't we? We've seen people with very fine personality who were not people of character, who didn't have the level of commitment that really should have been there to lead God's people. Personality and character are not one and the same thing. Young folks, I hate to say young people, that's not a very good way to say, talk to anybody during a sermon, because it sounds as if you, and I don't mean to talk down to anybody who's under the age of 50, because that's a definition of young people in the church today. So all of you folks out there who are under the age of 50, okay, please learn the lesson. Personality and character can be two different things. There are lots of people around who have very good personality, who tell good jokes, who are engaging, and who will get your attention, and sometimes there's an appeal for your loyalty and for you to follow them. And they're not necessarily one and the same thing. People who are in leadership should have good personality, but the character is foundational. And sometimes our discernment should tell us the difference. Our discernment needs to tell us the difference. Look for character before you look for personality. That's qualification, that's the basic, fundamental qualification for leadership and for service. Okay, so let's dig a little bit more out of Exodus chapter 32 as we're focusing on Moses here. Exodus 32, beginning in verse 11. This is interesting as well. Exodus 32 and verse 11, it says here, "Then Moses pleaded with the Eternal his God." Back in verse 10, what God tells Moses is, "Moses, I'm going to wipe the entire slate clean. And we're going to start all over again, and we'll start with you only, and we'll rebuild the nation through you." And the question, of course, immediately arises, well, could God have been faithful to the covenant promise if he had done this? And I think the answer is yes, in theory at least, he could have been. You know, Moses, several of the leaders in the Old Testament had more than one wife. We know that, that polygamy was tolerated up to a certain point in those at that time. And so could God have restarted with Moses, who was of the tribe of Levi, but, you know, kept all of the tribes going and so on? It was possible, at least in theory. He says, I'm going to wipe them all out and I'm going to start with you. Verse 11, Moses pleaded with the Eternal. And he said, Eternal, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you've brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Lesson, leaders sometimes intercede for those whom they serve. But let's keep reading because there's more here. Verse 12, why should the Egyptians speak and say, he brought them out to harm them and to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce wrath and relent from this harm to your people. And interestingly enough, as Moses appeals to God and he tries to intercede for the people, there are certain things he doesn't say. He doesn't say at this juncture, please forgive them because they're righteous people, because they weren't. I mean, this was huge. This was an enormous event. This was the one thing they were not supposed to do when they came out of Egypt. He says, be forgiving toward them. He appeals to God's character of forgiveness. And then in verse 13, he says, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, a.k.a. Jacob, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self, and you said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I've spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. And this is the appeal to the chesed factor, my favorite Hebrew word. And those who've taken my Old Testament classes are very familiar with that. If you don't know what chesed means, ask some of this year's FI students. They're here, or some of the graduates of our educational institutions. It's the appeal to God's covenant loyalty. God does not break covenant. And Moses appeals to that. He appeals to the covenant loyalty. And so, verse 14, the Eternal relented from the harm which he'd said he would do to his people. Lesson, leaders are concerned for those whom they serve. Leaders are concerned for the well-being of those whom they lead. This is how Moses acts. Not a terribly attractive personality. Not the most popular. I don't think he would have won a popularity contest, at least not at this point. But he wanted to intercede for the people, and he tries, and actually successfully, to get God to change his mind. Leaders are concerned for the well-being of those they serve. And now let's drop down again in Exodus chapter 32, and I realize we're jumping around. Let's go down to verse 30. Verse 30. Moses does something here which I think one could describe as noble, self-sacrificing. Exodus 32 and verse 30. It came to pass on the next day, Moses said to the people, you've committed a great sin, so now I will go up to the Eternal. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. He's looking for forgiveness. He's looking for atonement. As we heard in the sermonette, decisions get made, and even when there's forgiveness, sometimes the consequences of the decisions remain. Moses knew that. Verse 31, Moses returned to the Eternal, and he said, oh, these people have committed a great sin, and they've made for themselves a god of gold. This problem of idolatry is going to stay with them for centuries from this point forward. It was probably with them before that as well, when they came out of Egypt. Yet now, verse 32, if you will forgive their sin, and look at the way it is in your Bible in verse 32. You have a big long dash, a long horizontal line. If you will forgive their sin. And that verse is so interesting. Moses is about to intercede again and about to ask for forgiveness again, and yet he's sort of running out of arguments on which to base his appeal for forgiveness. If you will forgive their sin, and he's about to say, please, dot, 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 and he doesn't. He breaks off in the middle of his thought. And look at what he says in verse 32. He's sort of digging for something with which to make an appeal to God. But if not, I pray, blot me out of your book which you have written. What's Moses doing? Moses offers himself as a kind of a ransom. What Moses is doing at this point is, in effect, offering his own salvation in exchange for the forgiveness of the people of Israel. I'll give up my own future in God's kingdom. Oh, he didn't get to go into the promised land physically, but he'll get to go into the promised land spiritually. And he says, I'm willing to give it up. And then this very famous phrase that we've already read there in verse 33. God says to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I'll blot him out of my book. Human beings are responsible for their actions. And God rejected Moses' petition. And the petition was, I'll give up my future if you will please let them off for what they've done. And God says, no, it doesn't work that way. Everyone's responsible for their own actions. Remind you of anyone? Does that ring a bell? Can you think of somebody else in the Bible who did something actually very similar? Because he's also an object lesson in leadership. Let's turn forward to Romans chapter 9, a New Testament personality. And the Apostle Paul did something really quite similar here, as he loved his people too, just as Moses loved his people. Romans chapter 9 and verses 1 through 3. Romans 9, verses 1 through 3. The Apostle Paul in this section of the book of Romans is talking about national Israel and how he yearned for them, that they could find the way to salvation through Jesus Christ. He loved them. Of course, Paul was of the house of Judah and of the tribe of Benjamin, as we know. And he says something very similar to Moses. Romans 9, verse 1. Paul writes, I tell the truth in Christ, I'm not lying, my conscience bearing me witness in the Holy Spirit, that I have great sorrow and continual grief in my heart. I'm sure he meant this very, very sincerely. For I could wish that I myself were accursed from Christ. I wish I could be anathema from Christ, separated from Christ, if this could be done. For my brethren, my countrymen, according to the flesh, who are the Israelites, to whom pertain the adoption and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the service of God and the promises. Paul says something very similar to what Moses said back in Exodus chapter 32. I love them so much that I would give up my own salvation for them if that were possible. And of course it wasn't possible. Just as we read back in Exodus chapter 32, the one who sinned, he'll be the one whose name will be taken out of the book of life. Lesson. Leaders take responsibility not just for their own actions. And remember, Aaron failed to do that much. Leaders go above and beyond. Both the Apostle Paul and Moses were willing to go above and beyond, although actually God turned it down, and give themselves up, sacrifice their own future for the people whom they loved and served. There's lots there. There's a lot we can learn from all of this. I wonder how we react in a time of trial, in a time of crisis. We've seen the reactions of Aaron, evasive, lacking in character. Don't want to be too hard. We'll meet him at some point in the future. But certainly not a stellar example. The reaction of Joshua, a little naive, lacking in experience, more was to come. And he was going to learn, and he was going to grow as time went by, and as he gained new experience into a leader for God's people. But he started out low on the experience ladder. And finally, the example of Moses, who did the right thing, even when it was at cost of his own popularity. How would we have responded had we been there? How are our reactions when in our lives we confront the golden calf and when the temptation is there to join in with a big old party, as they say in Texas, at the bottom of the mountain? What are our reactions when the golden calf is right in front of us? Some pretty good lessons, I think, from the stories of three men and a calf.